Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Tea and Murder, an Agatha Christie podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Tundy Norman. We're part book club, part interview show, and all Agatha Christie. I am so excited to have here with me today Christian Hustil. Christian is working as a nurse supervisor in Copenhagen. He's been active most of his life in theatrical activities on and off stage, both in the Philippines and here in Copenhagen. He is currently directing The Mousetrap for Copenhagen Theatre Circle. Welcome, Christian.
Thanks.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Oh, good. So, Christian, tell me a little bit about whether or not you have a history with Agatha Christie's work outside of what you're doing with The Mousetrap right now.
Well, I mean, I grew up with the Poirot movies.
You did. Cool.
I've been a big fan of Poirot. And we recently just watched A Haunting in Venice, which was out like last week. And I really liked it because it was it's not like a reboot of one of the older movies. It's like something totally new, and Kenneth Branagh added a couple of new elements. So so Poirot and Miss Marple, those two things I've grown up with.
That's great. And so, did you watch those like as a kid?
Yeah. My dad and my mom and my sister were also fans of it. So yeah, I watched as a kid, and you know, I still watch the old movies again because you know I can't get enough of it. And you know, it's inspiring. I've always been a big fan of murder mysteries.
You have, and are there other types of murder mysteries that you enjoy?
Well, yeah, especially those that incorporate comedy.
Yeah.
I love guessing who, like trying to figure out who the murderer is. Mm. And when it comes to comedy, I mean, you can get away with anything. I mean, I think that's one of the big differences with comedic murder mysteries like Clue.
Yes.
Compared to The Mousetrap. It's like two different areas.
That's true. Clue is actually my favorite film of all time. So I am like 100% on board. I love the movie Clue.
Do you know that it's also made into a stage play?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I've never seen the play, but I love the movie, and it's just, for me, it's like the reaction comedy of that film is, I think, unsurpassed in anything I've ever seen. It's so funny.
Yeah, and it's not well known here in Denmark, which I find weird because we play Cluedo here.
That's right, yeah.
But, yeah.
So you're a murder mystery fan in general, and does that extend to books or are mostly kind of film and television?
I have to admit I've never been much of an avid book reader. Mm. I like the visual arts a lot. Mm-hmm. also because, you know, being in the nursing industry, I had enough books to read, so I didn't sure. need anything else on top of that. If I had to read something, I was mostly into fantasy fiction,
okay,
or spy stuff, like the John Clancy novels, or Tom Clancy, not John Clancy. I'm mixing two names now. Tom Clancy novels. Yeah. I like Peter Benchley novels, Mike Crichton novels. Those are the ones that I really like, but not really the murder mysteries.
Got it. So kind of the visual arts, and obviously that's why you went into theater. Mm-hmm. And you are now directing The Mousetrap for Copenhagen Theater Circle. Can you tell us a little bit about the theater itself, like Copenhagen Theater Circle, like what it is, what they do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is actually a very old theater group here in Copenhagen. It is more than 50 years old. It has been producing English-speaking theater for so long. Mm-hmm. It has, of course, evolved since then, taking on more types of shows, such as the British pantomimes, musicals, stage plays. And of course, we also do our like monthly play readings and monthly open stage events to give like more benefits to the membership. And, you know, it's also a great place for expats to meet. I mean, I'm half Danish myself, so. Mm-hmm. But seeing that I grew up in the Philippines, so I'm kind of half expat if you think about it. So it was a great way to meet other people, but also because I'd grown up with the English language. So for me, the English language in theater works best for me than Danish language. That's
okay.
just how I see it.
Cool. And you're directing The Mousetrap. Can you tell me a little bit about your journey to becoming a director? Like what is, you said you were both on and off stage. So what's been your journey with theater?
Well, when I was in school, I mean, of course everyone has to do the lovely school productions, both on and off stage. And, you know, I think like everyone else, I mean, we like the fame, we like having the spotlight and stuff, and then getting into community theater, that was the same thing. But then, you know, I guess getting older, I figured out that I actually like teaching people what I knew, like, and I love seeing people develop on stage. And one of the things I really love about directing is during the show nights, because I'm there usually all nights, watching them every single evening put even more details into their performances. Mm. And if the audience loves it, then I can like stay at the back and say, yes, I'm happy. So yeah, I mean, I don't feel like the need to be on stage anymore. I do it once in a while, but I prefer directing. I really like the aspect of developing people's talents and bringing them to a place of joy.
That's so great. And do you always direct English language theater, or have you done other languages as well?
I've never done Danish language. No, okay. That's I probably even wouldn't try. I prefer English language because that's what I grew up with.
And yeah.
It's I'd say it's easier for me to interpret stuff if it's in English. Yeah.
And in terms of being a director, can you tell me a little bit about like the tasks of a theater director? Like, are you casting the show, for example? Are you like finding where to actually stage the production? Like, how involved are you in kind of the logistical element of the show?
I guess it's different from every theater company, but mm-hmm. but me per se, I mean, I want to be involved in every step, and that's because it's all about the vision.
Mm-hmm.
If my vision is clear, then I have to have the right place. I have to have the right people involved, both on and off stage. I'm involved in every step. Like just today, my production manager sent me some pictures. Is this the prop that you're looking for? I'm like, yes, because they know that I look into specifics. I look into details.
Mm-hmm.
And my actors know that as well, that if there's anything that I focus on or can give feedback on, it's details on performances. So it's I prefer to involve myself. I wouldn't call myself a micromanager, but, you know, it is. I have also tried being in productions which I've directed, not with the Copenhagen Theater Circle. We're in like, this is my vision. And then of course the set is totally different. The costumes are totally different. I'm like, I can't do that.
Mm.
And also because it ends up falling back on me and me that, you know, gets, as I like to say, hagged for it, in lack of a better word.
I mean, it makes sense. At a certain point, if you're the director, right, and what is being produced is not what you want, where does the direction come in? You know, you have to feel like it was your kind of your creation in a way. Otherwise, what's the point?
Exactly. Also, because it is everyone. I mean, all the people involved are volunteers. So, you know, a little right. guidance, even though it takes more energy, it's also fine because, you know, it also helps me figure out like how far I can push people and what else I can also develop with the people off stage.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're a nurse. You said a nurse supervisor, like kind of during the day. And what does that entail?
The same thing. Practically the same thing.
You're asking about props.
Well, yeah, this would just be like catheters or
yeah, those IV are the nurse bags props.
Or yeah, the nurse props. I mean, I have a staff of 70 people.
Wow.
So it is all about developing and, you know, coordinating, planning.
Yeah.
The same thing as with being a director,
right?
And making sure that we're all in tune with the common vision or common goal.
Right. So taking kind of your nurse supervisor skills and having it be more of a creative outlet is the way you use direct, like theater direction.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, like last year because of COVID, I was supposed to like stage a British pantomime that got closed down.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a theater concert that also got closed down. And finally we were able to in 2022, the beginning of that, we were able to put up Snow White the Panto, British pantomime, as we call it. And after that, I just like needed a break, a whole year without doing anything at all involving theater. And I got bored because I don't have that creative outlet.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine I'm sure when you're doing a show, it's extremely exhausting. But when you're not doing it, it's like, where does that energy go?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my friends in the theater always describe me as like, yeah, Christian, he's always the one looking for something to stress about.
I can totally relate. So The Mousetrap is the longest running show of all time, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does undertaking a production of a show like that mean to you as a director?
Well, if I had to be honest, The Mousetrap wasn't my first choice.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say it wasn't my first choice. I haven't even seen The Mousetrap. So, you know, it's a, yeah, you know, I'm really giving a lot of facts now. And no, my first choice was actually Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay, well, fair enough.
It's because it's Poirot. That's what I grew up with,
yeah.
Right? But I couldn't get the rights for it. So,
okay.
And I wanted to do something Agatha Christie, so that's why I chose The Mousetrap. And
mm-hmm.
I've never seen it. I just read the script and like, hey, cool, this one would be fun to do.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it adds a lot of pressure because, you know, we had almost 60 people sign up for audition. I think over half of these people have seen The Mousetrap and I haven't seen it.
Right.
But, you know, it's also good. That's also what I told the cast. It's good because then I come with a fresh perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen YouTube videos or anything. I don't like watching things for references. I prefer figuring it out up in my head how I want it to look.
Mm-hmm.
Also because, you know, I don't want to be biased.
Mm.
I want it to be my own fresh production because, you know, it's also like it gives me it's a creative challenge.
Do you think you will go see a staging of it in London, maybe at the West End after the production?
I will, and I probably say, hey, mine's better.
Oh.
I always tend to do that. No, I mean, I of course want to watch it. I want to watch it.
Yeah, that would be really fun. And so why in particular did you want to do an Agatha Christie? Just because of your love of Poirot?
Well, the thing is, in 2019, I did Baskerville, a Sherlock Holmes mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a murder mystery, but it's a comedy murder mystery, which like involved different elements of the 39 Steps and Monty Python. And I'm also a big fan of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking like, I want to do something serious
mm-hmm.
this time, like a little bit more serious. And that's why I leaned over to Murder on the Orient Express, because the way the script was written, it was partly comedy in itself. And then since I couldn't get it, so I got to choosing the Mousetrap instead. I mean, there's no specific reason, but it is just because I love Agatha Christie. I love the way she writes. And there is actually a quote that I would like to share with you guys.
I would love to hear
and
that.
It's been my mantra throughout the whole directing process. Crime is terribly revealing. Try and vary your methods as you will. Your tastes, your habits, your attitude of mind, and your soul is revealed by your actions. So throughout the whole rehearsal process, it's all about been dropping breadcrumbs, but confusing breadcrumbs. Mm-hmm. And that has been like one of the most enjoyable parts for me. Because like I keep on telling the cast, it's either you make it or you break it when you're dropping the breadcrumbs. I mean, it's like being obvious, but then again, not being too obvious. Mm. It's like those things. So we've been working a lot with body languages, with their tones of voice or their inflection patterns. Mm. And that's the beauty of Agatha Christie. I mean, it's always, as I always say, it's always the person you least expect it to be. I mean, I didn't even guess who the killer was in the I did not see that coming.
Yeah, it's a real twist ending. It's not just a whodunit, it's a twist. Do you plan at the end of the show to do the traditional please don't spoil this for other audiences?
Oh yes.
Okay, great.
Oh yes.
Great.
And we've already been rehearsing it with the bows, so
oh, that's
yeah.
So fun. Amazing. So I am going to do a little historical note about the Mousetrap, and then we mm-hmm. are going to dive into the more kind of book club or play club, I guess, section mm-hmm. of the podcast. So The Mousetrap is a play that premiered at the Theatre Royale in Nottingham in 1952 with a pre-London run through November, which was about a month long of that same year, when it began showing at the Ambassador's Theatre in London's West End. And it continuously ran until the COVID-19 pandemic forced it to close in March of 2020 and then started up again in May 2021. It is the longest running play of all time, as we've said before. The Mousetrap is based on a short story called Three Blind Mice, which itself was based on a short radio play by Christie. Three Blind Mice, the short story, was published as part of the collection Three Blind Mice and Other Stories in the US in 1950. It actually has not been published in the UK due to Christie's request that it not be published while the play ran. She obviously did not expect the play to run forever. The story is based on a real-life incident in 1945 in which a child named Dennis O'Neill was killed at the hands of his foster parents in Shropshire. He had a brother who testified to their treatment named Terry O'Neill. And the case actually contributed to a pretty significant overhaul of the British foster care system, including that children could not be fostered by those with criminal convictions. The original cast included Richard Attenborough, yes, that Richard Attenborough, as Detective Sergeant Trotter, but overall, Christie and the play itself are what get top billing rather than the actors, who switch over every year. There have been some star-filled productions, including the 25,000th performance in 2012, which included Patrick Stewart, Julie Walters, and Hugh Bonneville. Critical reception when the piece premiered was overall pretty middling without any expectation that the play would take off in the way that it did. And I don't think Christie did either. In fact, she was quoted as saying that she expected it to run for about 8 months. The end of every performance, as we talked about, requests that the audience members do not reveal the killer to others. And the 2022 film See How They Run, starring Sam Rockwell and Saoirse Ronan, featured the 100th staging of The Mousetrap and built a kind of whodunit around the writers, actors, and directors of the play, and the character of Agatha Christie herself even makes a very small appearance. So I don't know if you've seen that film, but it's, I don't know if I'd recommend it, but it's quite fun and sweet in its way. So that is a little note about The Mousetrap. Christian, will you give us a 1 minute or so synopsis of The Mousetrap?
Yeah, sure.
And I'll request that you don't give spoilers, as we've been asked
by
Christian
how to do.
Oh, don't
worry. I am prepared.
Fantastic.
So with an unexpected series of events and eccentric characters, Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap strands seven strangers at Monkswell Manor guest house during a blizzard. But a police sergeant unexpectedly arrives, worried that a murderer at large is among the guests of the manor. Before he can investigate, one of the guests is killed, starting an investigation into the lives and histories of everyone there. One of them is the killer, and another one of them may be next. Will the police be able to solve the case before another mouse falls?
Wow, that was very good. Thank you. I love your synopsis. That was exactly right and perfect. As we've already said, this is the longest running play of all time. We've said that a few times. What is it about The Mousetrap that you think keeps audiences coming back? I mean, it didn't really get a great critical reception, as I said in the historical note, but people seem to really love it. What is it about this play?
Well, I have been talking about it with my cast, and I think it's because it's just, I mean, even if people know the story, it's just seeing how the characters are portrayed by each of the different set of actors. I mean, mm-hmm. like you mentioned, that the actors get changed every year. And I think it's like, they just want to see a new take on how the play is done. And, you know, I guess even if it's set in the 50s, I mean, I guess there will always come a couple of modern twists underways. If you'd ask my opinion, I mean, if I'd lived in the UK, I'd probably also watch it a couple of times because it is an enjoyable thing. And, you know, it is like, it's just like reliving it and seeing, like, does it do the same for me again? I think that's what makes it a fun ride.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people keep coming back. It's like the Phantom of the Opera. I mean, I've seen it like 4 times. I still want to watch it again.
Right.
I guess it's the same thing.
When you enjoy it. Yeah. And I think you're right about the characters, in the sense that each character is such an archetype. There is something really, like, I don't want to say over the top about each character, but they like are really a character, you know, and to see how different people would play them with maybe some subtlety, with maybe a little bit more drama, however they choose to play them, could be really interesting and fun, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, when I was reading up on the history of The Mousetrap, that Richard Attenborough was in it, like, I was just like, wait, Jurassic Park dude was in it? Like, my first reaction, like, I have a hard time seeing that. But then again, he was in the Rex Harrison film, Dr. Dolittle, where he was singing and dancing. I'm just like, wait, that's Jurassic Park dude.
I know. People, that's the thing about actors, right? They can be so many people.
Exactly.
But I think for me also, in rereading the play, and I've only seen it once many years ago, but in rereading it, I was struck by how many of Christie's elements it really brings in. And I think the same reason people keep rereading her books is the same reason they would want to continue seeing The Mousetrap. There's a lot of comfort in a play like The Mousetrap. You have the Monkswell Manor setting. You have the blizzard. Everyone's kept inside. It's a closed space. You have all these kind of character archetypes. You have the kind of little romance of this couple who's just starting out. And I just think there's a lot of elements of it that people would find really comforting, in the same way they would find any Christie mystery comforting.
Yeah, and I mean, basing on the different movies that I've seen of Agatha Christie, I mean, it's always whoever's going to solve the case always like locks people in, and it's always some deserted place, and you know, you tend to see some patterns, but I mean, I guess that's also what's fun about these patterns. It's because it's like that's what keeps you guessing as to who the killer is. I mean, like with Murder on the Orient Express, I mean, the first time I saw it, I was like blown away. I was like, okay, I did not see that coming
right
at all.
Well, that's a real shock ending. And there's really no way to guess that's what's going to happen.
Exactly.
And whereas I think, I mean, you were saying you kind of like figuring out the puzzles with the mysteries. I've never been a particularly puzzle-driven mystery fan. Like, I just like the atmosphere and the characters and all these things. But I know there are lots of people who love the puzzles. And I do think once you know the twist ending of The Mousetrap, you can track it backwards. So you could potentially have guessed, but I don't think it's necessarily an obvious one at all. It's quite a hard one to guess.
Yeah, and I mean, with like, let's just take the new Poirot film, Haunting in Venice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guessed who the killer was halfway, and I was like 100% sure, and I got it right. And that's because I think after working with the whole Agatha Christie thing, I started seeing the patterns again all throughout the film.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know, but I think it's kind of an amalgamation of some different books. So it's not exactly based on just one specific one.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
exactly. It's great that there's like a whodunit element that you can actually puzzle out, which is very fun, I think, for watchers. Have you read the short story that The Mousetrap is based on, Three Blind Mice?
No, I actually haven't.
Okay. I would recommend reading it too. It's I went back and read it as well. And because when I was reading it, I was going, I'm really sure I've read this in another form. And I realized then when I was doing the research that obviously it was in this short story form. And it's quite a lovely short story as well. But I do prefer the play. And I think the reason I prefer the play is because Christie, as a playwright, does such a great job of setting the scene in terms of like how people move around the stage and like the location that they're in. So I thought it was really great to read it in that way. And
I'll make a note of that. Now you piqued my interest.
I've piqued your interest. Oh, good. I'm glad. So in a previous episode, we spoke with an opera composer named Matthias Vestergaard, and he shared that there are not typically mystery operas because it's hard to get the intricacies of the narrative across when people are singing as opposed to speaking. Obviously, that's not necessarily the case in a play, but I'd imagine that you still need to like hold audience attention in order to make a mystery work. What are some key elements in regards to staging a mystery in order to keep the suspense going that you have found while directing this play?
That would bring me back to my previous quote. It's all about the breadcrumbs.
Mm.
It's all about like finding, like making sure that there's a continuous thread throughout the whole play or throughout the whole mystery process, making sure that there are no loose ends, especially like I've been saying to the cast, remember your entrances and exits, remember where you're supposed to stand, because if you don't, that's gonna give it away. So it's stuff like that that we've been playing a lot with. And also how we speak, the volume, the accents, how much emotions you put in. I mean, everything has to be perfectly well balanced, and that's what I think is really marvelous with Agatha Christie's work, is that it is really balanced. But but then again, if putting up a murder mystery, like I said, it's either you make it or you break it. I mean, you can give too much or you can give too little. And I think the dialogue is really essential in itself, and compared to singing opera, I mean, I think you would lose everything if you tried to do like a murder mystery on stage. I would like to see it tried, of course. I do agree that it might be too difficult. But yeah, I mean, I think it's like it's really like being clear on your vision, making sure that you have a mantra, like I've had throughout the whole rehearsal process, making sure that your cast has good teamwork, good community spirit, because I think that's a way to like also so that they can like help each other throughout the whole process. Also because I mean, like the Mousetrap in itself, it has so many words and a lot of words which even I do not understand, so that we've even like had to make a glossary of the words for our programs, because I would say that I think a lot of people would probably find it difficult to understand, like ration books. I mean, I thought they were cookbooks, but apparently it means something else.
I did not
see that coming. But yeah, I mean, to keep the suspense going, it's figuring out the breadcrumbs, figuring out the mood, figuring out the atmosphere.
And the initial kind of, when you're initially getting the play started, were there times where you felt like you kind of went in the direction and then had to pivot because it wasn't working in terms of the mystery?
I would say that, I mean, I think it would be easier if I like describe how my rehearsal process has been.
Sure, go ahead.
We started with that. And after I cast them, I give them all their scripts and I ask them to like think about their characters, write stuff down, everything from A to Z of body language, all these elements that I'm looking for. And then we had like character development sessions, we had team building sessions to get them into place. And then throughout the whole rehearsal process, the play in itself, it has a lot of stage directions. I've had to change some of it because it did not make sense with what I was thinking of in my head. So yes, I would have to say at some points where we would reach a point, I would say like, okay, let's turn right now, because we can't keep on going straight ahead. I mean, we can't take it word for word. We have to change it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, there are, I mean, there are a lot of stage directions in the play.
Yeah.
And is that, as a director, is that usually helpful, or is that something that kind of you feel hems you in a bit?
I'd say both. I mean, it's nice to have, I mean, it's nice to have stage directions to like make the process easier.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can modify it from there. I mean, right. one of the great things with the script is that it even has a lighting plan.
It, yes,
even
it does.
It has a set design. I'm just like, this is something I have never tried before where everything is practically served to me.
Right.
And I see why it's served. It's because it's to keep all the elements in place, because if you start changing things up, then you start losing that thread that's going throughout the whole story. Mm-hmm. So, and then that's one of the things that I think also my cast was having a hard time with, because they've been so focused with their characters, their lines, they totally forgot about the stage directions.
Yeah.
I'm like, I know I'm going to modify it, but start figuring out, so where is the sofa, where is the large armchair and this and that, because it's important that you get those things right.
Yeah. That's so interesting, because when I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, gosh, this is a lot of stage direction for a play. And it never occurred to me, as you're saying right now, what you need it for the tightness of the mystery. That's actually what it's all hinging on. And that is such a great point. And I'm sure as a director, that just came home to you again and again while you were staging it.
Yeah. I mean, even when we started rehearsing act two after the summer break, I mean, there were some parts that even during act one, just like, why is it they're going through here again? Why is it they're sitting down here? And then in act two, that's why. Now it makes sense.
Right.
That's why they've been written in, and that's why the whole design is there. It is because of to keep the tightness of the play to its key. Yeah,
totally. So the Mousetrap doesn't have, you know, either of Christie's great detectives, Poirot or Marple. And she often removed Poirot from stagings of her plays when she kind of did play versions of her Poirot books, because she felt that he would draw too much attention on the stage. Do you think the play could have been like harmed or benefited from a character like Poirot, and do you think, or and like, what do you think of Christie's reasoning for removing him?
I mean, I do see the point, because I mean, judging from the Miss Marple movies and TV series as well as the Poirot, I mean, you're always focused on him. You're always focused on like him, and then everything else is like a nice to have. So I do get it. I mean, one of the other Agatha Christie movies that I've always liked is also Death on the Nile. And then I found out that it was, you know, based on Murder on the Nile, the play, which is based on Death on the Nile, the movie. And no, I mean, the book, sorry. And the Murder on the Nile play didn't even have Poirot in
That's
it.
That's right,
I'm just like, why? It doesn't make sense. But then after I read it, I'm like, okay, now it makes sense.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, I actually do agree with her reasoning. It will take the attention away. I mean, I think it's the same thing with all these, like, Disney reboots of movies. I mean, if you take, like, Mary Poppins Returns, I know Julie Andrews was asked to do a cameo, but she said no because it would take the attention away from Emily Blunt playing the new Mary Poppins.
Aww,
so
that's
I
nice.
I kind of get it.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with a lot of the other Disney reboots. I mean, like in The Little Mermaid, I mean, even the one who voiced Ariel, I mean, she was there just for a little bit, but she didn't want any more, because it is the whole thing about not taking the attention away from the main person, otherwise there will always be a comparison. So yeah,
that's interesting. So you don't feel like the Mousetrap could have, for example, benefited from a Poirot type character?
No, because you know what, sometimes you just need normal people. Poirot was normal. I mean,
no,
Poirot
he
was
like,
I
as
mean,
far away from normal as you can possibly be.
Yeah,
with
I mean,
love.
Exactly. I mean, Poirot is Poirot is egotistical, and he doesn't, and I describe him almost as having obsessive compulsive disorder. That's why he fits being a detective, because I mean, everything, as he says, this is the best Belgian accent I can do. Everything has to make sense. That's the best I can
do.
But
I mean,
everything has to fall in. Everything has to fall into place. If there's asymmetry, something's wrong.
Yeah.
Right. And if you had someone like that in the Mousetrap, I mean, then you'd be focused on that.
That's true.
Because that's what we liked with the Poirot movie. That's what we liked with the Miss Marple movies. It is how they solved the murder mystery.
Mm.
And with the Mousetrap, it just totally turned it around.
And yeah.
This is where I'm not going to say anymore because then there's going to be too much spoilers.
Yeah, don't spoil it. But no, I completely agree with you. I think one of the great joys of the Mousetrap is its kind of normalcy. You're kind of, you know, there's an extraordinary situation happening in quite a normal setting to these fairly normal type characters. I completely agree with you. Of this play, what was the most difficult scene to stage?
I would say it was the scene when all of them were on stage at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Because I've had to like watch each and every one of them. And, you know, I only have a pair of eyes. I'm watching 8 people on stage and watching how much they give away or how less they give away, listening to them at the same time and making sure that the whole balance. I think those were the most difficult scenes to stage. I wouldn't say that it was discouraging, but I mean, it was to the point where I was really like pulling my hair. I'm like, this has to work. This has to work. But, you know, the more we do it, the more people settle into the roles and the more it starts falling into place. I mean, like we had rehearsals yesterday and everything just paid off. I mean, I was just so happy to see that everyone was really settling into the roles. And the thing is, I could like already compared to last week's rehearsal, I saw that they've already built like a level more. And that's what they know that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I mean, more, because the more that they are their roles on stage, then the more that the audience will be awed and wowed away.
Yeah, and taken to that place, right?
Yeah.
That's so exciting. It must be really, really rewarding as a director to have those kind of next level moments.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what is the most fun scene to stage in this play?
I would have to say it's the over the top character, Mr. Paravicini.
He is so over the top.
Yeah, and you know, it's like I call him comic relief.
He is comic relief,
And the person that I cast in that role, his name is Rudy, he's American.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, we've been talking back and forth about like, what should his accent be? And you know, at some point, I mean, during the read through, I mean, like I said to Rudy, I don't mind that your breadcrumb dropping is your accent, but please decide what kind of accent you're trying to drop. Because I heard like Arabic, Chinese and everything. Like, please try to like stick to maybe just 2 or 3.
Okay.
Yeah. And then of course we were doing like costume and makeup tests, and at some point I was looking at him like, you remind me of Inspector Clouseau. I like this. We'll go along with this.
Yeah.
But I mean, his scenes are for me like the most absolute fun.
That's so great.
Because you know, it's like it makes people laugh. But this is all in Act One. In Act Two, this is not how it is anymore. That's when the mood changes.
Like, yes,
changes totally.
It is a big tone shift. So in terms of the tone, it's so much of it has to do with the location, but also the snow, the fact that they're snowed in. And I love how Christie does settings in her books and also obviously in this play. How do you evoke that kind of the setting of Monkswell Manor and the feeling of being snowed in on the stage?
Well, we have, of course, aside from the dialogue and their emphasis on it and like coming inside from the cold and how they move and how they feel, but at the same time, we're incorporating lighting, sound effects, and of course our lovely smoke machine to give us the mist.
Ooh.
And my set designer, we were, because there's this set, the setup is like you have a window, and that this is because the window gets used a lot during the whole play. But so we've also been looking like, can you like put a tree there? Can you like put some like snow residues on it? But I mean, we're relying heavily also on people's imagination, because like I keep on saying to everyone, I mean, you don't have to like see everything. Sometimes it's also good to have the imagination there, and you just need a couple of elements, and that's like sound effects and lighting to help us along the way.
Yeah. So this podcast has focused a lot, actually exclusively, except for this episode, on Christie's books. But I really enjoyed reading this play and getting to think about her as a playwright. why do you think that we should keep reading her plays as part of this podcast? What do plays offer that books maybe don't offer?
I would say, I mean, if we just take The Mousetrap alone, and we were talking about this whole thing with stage directions, I think it gives you like an idea of how people move.
Mm-hmm.
I think it builds a bigger vision. And I mean, one of the fun things that I thought about this was like, when I was reading the script, is just like with the stage directions, I was even like drawing a map of stuff, like just to see what was happening and like how people would be moving. And I think like it just builds the imagination more. I'd say books have the same effect, but I mean the books tell a story, and the plays are meant to like give you something even more visual compared to books.
Mm-hmm.
Books can take you so many ways, but I mean a play is more like, I think it's more like straightforward. With how it's built, and especially with the Mousetrap.
Yeah. I agree. And I also think that, I mean, obviously playwriting is a totally different form of writing, but you can see with Christie, one of the things she's so good at in her books, and particularly in her short stories, which are very short, is creating kind of location, setting, and characterization in like a sentence, very short strokes. And she does that in the plays as well, but even more so because you're really only able to do that through dialogue and movement. So I was just kind of blown away to see, like, you could, especially having read the short story, see how she made that into an entirely dialogue-based, piece of art, and still had all the same, like, evoked the same emotions, had the same effect. It was really incredible to see that transition, and I really enjoyed it.
Okay, well, now you really sold me on it. I have to read Three Blind Mice then.
You should. Yeah, but you know, I think even if you don't, you know, it's not like, I don't think you need to read the story in order to understand the play better or anything like that. But I just think
I mean, it's just like especially how you described it, like that whole comparison of how you changed into dialogue. Because I mean, the thing is, I mean, with novels, I mean, you can always describe like he said it disgruntedly.
Right.
I mean, with plays, you don't see that. You have to play that out for yourself. You have to figure that out. And that's one of the things we've also been working on, is like how long can you stretch words? I mean, you can't do that with novels, but you can do that with plays. And I mean, I have read, Murder on the Nile and Death on the Nile, the book,
mm-hmm.
and I can also see the differences in it. I mean, the elements are still there, but I mean, it does offer another take on it. And the thing is with plays, I mean, it's like it's also open to interpretation,
yes,
compared to the novels, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a great experience, and thank you for reminding me, really, that I enjoy reading her as a playwright, not just as a novelist and a short story writer. So that was a really just a fun experience. I really enjoyed reading The Mousetrap and getting to think about what it would be like for you as a director to be staging this. And I'm super excited to see the play when it comes out in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. I mean, the pressure is on from us, but you know, that's...
do you feel a lot of pressure, or is it feeling just like it's kind of building to the right place?
I mean, I don't feel pressured with the actors. I mean, with them, I mean, after from what I saw yesterday, like I said, you can practically put your costumes on and you're on stage, you'll be fine.
Amazing.
But I mean, there's always the aspects of the production
that
need to fall into place. And, you know, I think it's also nerves, also for my part as a director, because, you know, because it has been one of the place that has run the longest in the West End, and is now opening on Broadway at the same time. So, you know, there is a little bit of pressure that I feel. It's also because I want, it's not for, like I said, it's not for my sake. I just want everyone to have a good experience. And I think that's where the pressure lies.
Yeah.
Lies for me.
I think this is, I mean, based on your clear passion and understanding of the play, but also this is the kind of play that is meant to make people feel good and enjoy themselves, and it's got that kind of built into it in terms of its structure. So I think it will be fantastic, and I'm super excited to see it.
Cool.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, Christian. I really appreciate it. And I hope you had a good time talking about Agatha Christie.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. It was really great getting an insight into like the Three Blind Mice, because like, what did I not come even more prepared? But never mind. But also like learning about this whole podcast, because I mean, it came as a total surprise to me. And so I'm really happy to be on it. I've actually been listening to some of your other episodes, so
aww,
just to give you an idea how it is. But you know, it's like anything, like I said, anything that's murder mystery on stage, I'm all in.
I totally agree with you, and yeah, let me know about all the other murder mysteries that are going to be staged, because I would love to see anything that's coming out.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
You
again.
Never know. You
yeah,
never
exactly.
Know.
Thank you again for being here, Christian. I really appreciate it. And where can people find? Would you like the people to find you? And where can you be found, if so?
Are we talking about me or the group or
both?
Or
both. We're talking about both. If you want to share a little bit more about like where people can find Copenhagen Theater Circle, that would be great. And then also if you have like personal, you know, website or social media or anything like that.
Okay. Well, our website is www.ctcircle.dk.
Great.
You can find a lot about the Mousetrap, and then our next production, which is Around the World in 80 Days.
Ooh, fun.
Another classic,
yeah,
coming up. Yeah. And then we are also on Facebook, Copenhagen Theater Circle, and on Instagram, CT Circle PK.
Fantastic.
We always have a lot of updates. You can also sign up for a newsletter and such. And we are going to, the cast and ourselves, the production team, we're also going to be at International Citizens Day on Saturday.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
If people listening to this, are going to be there, then come and say hi.
And this will probably come out a little bit after that, but
okay.
But yeah, but it's good to know that you're there. That's a great event to attend.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, and if you want, I mean, the play readings that we have, and as well as our open stages, these are not exclusive to members. These are open to the public. So
that's fantastic. Yeah,
it's also a good way to network.
It is. We always have your events on. I run a website called Scandinavia Standard, and we always have your events on our calendar.
And
they're very popular. So that's fantastic. So we will put all of that in the episode notes if people want to learn more about Copenhagen Theater Circle, especially for English-speaking people in Copenhagen. It is a great way to enjoy English theater and to meet other English-speaking people if that's what you want to do. And also just to enjoy theater, take your kids. There's always great locations like where they're staging the production. So it's really fun.
Yeah.
Thank you again for being here, Christian. And I really appreciate it. And I hope you have a great night.
You too.
Okay,
thank you very
thanks.
Much.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you to our producer, Kate Grishel, and our sound engineer, Winter Robinson. To stay up to date and get some extra fun info, you can follow us on Instagram at TNMurder. Rating and reviewing us really helps, so please do that if you feel so inclined. We're on all your favorite podcast platforms. Remember to follow us there and recommend us to anyone you think might need a little tea and or murder in their lives. Are you ready for Agatha Christie's astrological chart? I am. Next book in the club is The Pale Horse. Rent it from your local library, buy from your local independent bookstore, or if you need to buy online, we recommend bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores with every purchase. A link for next episode's book can be found in the episode notes. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Tea and Murder. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week in In fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.